Words are weapons. They can inspire revolutions, sell products, win elections, and break hearts. When Martin Luther King Jr. declared, "I have a dream," he wasn't just speaking, he was wielding rhetoric, an ancient art that has shaped civilization for over 2 millennia. In Words Like Loaded Pistols, Sam Leith reveals how the techniques of Aristotle and Cicero continue to dominate our discourse today. This isn't just academic theory, it's practical power. That's why this book sits on nightstands at Harvard Business School and in Silicon Valley mansions. In our rhetoric economy, mastery of persuasion might be the most valuable skill you can possess. Every time you argue with your partner, pitch an idea at work, or scroll through social media, you're swimming in a sea of rhetoric. The question isn't whether you'll encounter it, it's whether you'll recognize it when you do, or remain at the mercy of those who have mastered its techniques. Rhetoric permeates our language so thoroughly we rarely notice it. That rhetorical question? That's erotema. The rhythmic three-part slogan? That's tricolon. For centuries, rhetoric formed the core of Western education, studied by kings, philosophers, and merchants alike. Though largely absent from formal curricula today, rhetoric's influence has only grown. Our politics, advertising, and conversations are fundamentally rhetorical. As economy shifted to services, persuasive communication became increasingly valuable, less a knowledge economy than a rhetoric economy. Rhetoric stands on three pillars Aristotle called the absolute bedrock of persuasion. Ethos establishes your credibility with the audience. Politicians shape their ethos, like George W. Bush downplaying his Yale education to appear as a Texan roughneck. Logos works through enthymemes, simplified logical arguments with hidden assumptions. When politicians claim high taxes hurt jobs, they're skipping several logical steps. Rhetoric aims for beyond reasonable doubt rather than mathematical certainty. Pathos taps into emotions, not just sadness, but excitement, fear, patriotism, and humor. Charity fundraisers don't show statistics, they show the dying child. Nixon's Checkers speech masterfully used pathos, turning accusations of financial impropriety into demonstrations of his everyman values. Ever wonder why great speeches feel so natural yet powerful? They follow an architecture developed over millennia. After determining what to say, invention, you must arrange your material effectively. As Quintilian noted, a speech with incorrectly arranged parts becomes a monster. The classical structure begins with the exordium, making your audience receptive and attentive. Steve Jobs mastered this in his 2005 Stanford address, combining flattery with self-deprecation while previewing his content. Next comes narration, establishing the essential context. Obama's 2008 economic crisis speech compared the situation to the Great Depression. Division follows, summarizing points of agreement before outlining disputed issues, ideally limiting enumerated points to 3. Proof showcases logos, while refutation addresses counterarguments. Clinton's denial about Monica Lewinsky exemplifies refutation through redefinition. Finally, the peroration delivers your emotional climax. Frederick Douglass's 1852 Fourth of July address builds to powerful condemnation. "What to the American slave is your Fourth of July?" he asked, answering that it revealed only gross injustice and cruelty. Style isn't mere decoration. It's persuasion working at the language level itself. A skilled orator commands multiple styles, deploying them strategically within a single speech. The high style employs elaborate metaphors and sophisticated vocabulary. The middle style balances grandeur with plain speaking, while the plain style values clarity and brevity. Decorum, fitting language to audience expectations, guides these choices. We practice this instinctively through accommodation, adapting our speech for different contexts. This explains why job applications avoid text speak and courtroom testimony differs from casual conversation. Online communities exaggerate decorum through rapidly evolving memes that mark group identity. The sonic quality of rhetoric is fundamental to its effectiveness, whether heard aloud or through the inner ear while reading. As W.H. Auden defined poetry as memorable speech, rhetorical sound patterns serve mnemonic purposes. Repetition makes language memorable and meaningful. Churchill's great rolling periods demonstrate how sound effects work beneath conscious comprehension, affecting listeners emotionally while meaning occupies their rational mind. His promise to fight on beaches, landing grounds, fields, streets, and hills created an emotional surge through rising rhythm that pure logic never could. Before teleprompters, speakers memorized vast amounts of material. The ancients valued this skill highly. Seneca could reportedly recite 2,000 names after hearing them once. They understood memory spatially, creating memory palace techniques where ideas were mentally placed within familiar architectural spaces. This spatial approach aligns with how memory works. Studies show the hippocampus handles both spatial awareness and memory. Modern speakers typically use simpler methods, though the memory palace concept endures. Historian Tony Judt used it to compose essays after becoming immobilized by motor neuron disease. Delivery transforms crafted speech into a live experience. Unlike writers, speakers can read and respond to audience reactions in real time. Cicero demonstrated this mastery against Catiline, using audience responses to fuel his attack. Effective delivery requires voice control and purposeful gesture. Nervous speakers typically talk too fast. Slowing down to what feels unnaturally slow is often perfect. John Bulwer's 1644 Chirologia attempted to systematize hand gestures, believing nature could be improved by art. Yet authenticity remains paramount. As Lord Mancroft noted, a speech is like a love affair. Any fool can start it, but to end it requires considerable skill. Behind history's most memorable words often stands an unsung hero, the speechwriter. While we honor unknown soldiers, no memorial exists for the unknown speechwriter who crafts words that move nations. This anonymous work is unfairly viewed with suspicion, as if lending language were deception rather than craft. Peggy Noonan, Reagan's speechwriter, approached her work as part theater, part political declaration, and art. She immersed herself in the speaker's cadence, elevating their voice while maintaining authenticity. Her masterpiece, Reagan's Pointe du Hoc D-Day anniversary speech, channeled the emotional power of addressing veterans into Reagan's Cold War message. The poignancy of this anonymous role emerged when Reagan later told Noonan, "I used to write my own speeches, you know," revealing the complex relationship between speakers and ghostwriters. Their craft remains essential to democratic discourse, though their names rarely appear alongside the leaders whose words they helped immortalize. Rhetoric isn't academic theory. It's the weather of human communication. From conversations to speeches, rhetoric shapes how we understand each other. The patterns across centuries reveal our commonality, with appeals to emotion, logic, and character working as effectively today as in ancient Athens. In our persuasion-dominated world, rhetorical literacy serves as essential self-defense. Recognizing persuasive techniques gives you power over them, while mastering these techniques enables you to move others toward truth and justice. When you hear political speeches, analyze advertisements, or craft important emails, you're participating in an ancient tradition that has shaped civilization for millennia. Words aren't just symbols. They're loaded pistols, capable of destruction or protection depending on who wields them.